as kids, and a Ghostbusters cartoon wafted over the television. "Hold your fire, Peter. I think he wants to talk." He worked as a production operator, which was a fancy name for a pumper, for Amoco, over in the North Cowden Field, west of town. The work was hot and dry and as monotonous as the maddening slow-poke motion of the pump jacks themselves. He checked them to make sure they worked correctly. Although his name was a household word among Permian fans, he didn't have season tickets anymore. Although he had been on a state championship team, he never saw any of his old teammates, nor did he ever hear from them. Although just about everyone in town knew his name, he almost never went out, because it was hard to find a babysitter, which was all right, because he loved his wife and three boys. But there was also a limited amount he could do with them. The Texas Longhorns had washed their hands of him and let him go after they found someone who played safety better than he ever could, but he still carried the legacy of the Longhorns with him. He felt it during the mornings when he couldn't bend over to tie his shoes. He felt it when it became painfully difficult to throw a ball. He felt it when he had to stop playing flag football because his body couldn't take it. Bizzell traced the problem to his freshman year at Texas. He had been playing on the freshman team and was hit head-on in a game against Baylor. He couldn't walk for 3 days because of pain in his back. And then he was called up to the varsity. He showed up in street clothes, and Bizzell said it was made clear to him that if he didn't make good on this opportunity, he could go back down to the freshman team and rot there for the rest of his life. He said he was fitted in a corset and played in it all year on the presumption it was a sprain. But he said a doctor had looked at his back recently and told him he needed fusion surgery if he wanted it to get better. "I've learned to live with it, I know that," said Joe Bob Bizzell. "My wife don't like that, but shit, I'm not going to get cut on." In the meantime, he had finally come to grips with what had happened in his life and what hadn't. But it had taken a painfully long time, and it wasn't until the year before that he had finally explained it all to his wife, after she repeatedly asked him what was wrong, what was eating away at him. He had cried when Daryl Royal told him he was kicking him off the team. Football was his identity, his life, the one and only thing people knew him for. "That's all I knew how to do was football," said Joe Bob Bizzell, the golden boy of golden boys. "It had been my life." He felt he had been used as an example, and it was hard for him to see the evils of having a marijuana pipe when you could purchase them all over Austin. There had been other players on the team who smoked dope and did drugs, but there were those who got away with it because of who they were, and those who did not. Had he been given the chance, he believed that he could have had a career like the one he had had at Permian. After that, he believed he would have had a shot at the pros. He even tried to walk on with the Cowboys in 1978, but they told him he was too slow and didn't bother to give him a tryout. "I wish I could have had an opportunity to play pro. Not a 10 or 13-year-old career, but maybe 1 or 2 years, and maybe get a different job." At Permian, it had been victory after victory. It was one exciting week after another, and the world seemed only to consist of cheers and praise and glory and rules that had no meaning. He made 20-odd interceptions his sophomore year, and in one game alone against Abilene Cooper, took down 5. It was hard sometimes not to wish those days were back, because there seemed something so old-fashioned, so wholesome, so simple and unfettered about them. It had all fallen apart after that, and though he wished it had turned out differently, he wasn't so much embittered by it as hurt. "I'd do it all over again," he said. He looked up with those sad eyes, and then came the deep laugh out of nowhere that didn't sound like a laugh at all, rising over the scratchy rattle of Ghostbusters on the television screen. Daniel Justice would have been another to receive a standing ovation at the pep rally that night. He was All-State and had also gone to State. But Justice hated the game of football and wanted his son to do the same, and had programmed him to think that anyone who played it was a fool. "I'm going to have a negative influence on him," said Justice. "If he wants to play, I'm going to steer him into every other sport. I don't think he has to play football to get an education. He doesn't have to play football to be somebody or not. Maybe in my mind, I didn't think I was anybody unless I played football." He was the first to admit that football had helped him become a dentist. It was also a nice drawing card for his practice, since just about everyone knew he had been the star running back on a Permian team that went to the finals in 1970. It was hard to forget, with the messages on the sign of Temple Baptist that said, "Give Arlington justice, not mercy." Or the banner headline in Pearl Harbor black that said, "Justice for Permian, 22-19. But he still hated the game. As he told it, it may have been because of the arthritis in both hips, or the one arm that was shorter than the other, or the constant pain in his legs. It may have been because of the two separated shoulders. It may have been because he threw up and shit all over the place before games with the realization that you're going out on the field and getting the shit knocked out of you. It may have been because of the coach in ninth grade who thought he was faking a broken arm and wouldn't let him leave the practice field until the fluid built up. But it also may have been, as his wife Janet suggested, that despite how much he hated it or tried to hate it, he couldn't get it out of his blood. And he missed the adulation and attention, missed the woman in Dallas who had commissioned a Black Panther statue for him, missed the Pearl Harbor black headlines, missed the church sign slogans. "You live in a fairy tale for that one year of your life," said his wife. "You're worshipped, and that year is over, and you're like anyone else." We all feel that our husbands have been unhappier with everything after they got out of it. You see your name up in lights, and people follow you, and they put your name in the newspaper, and then all of a sudden, the season is over. It was a phenomenon that Trapper had seen dozens of times before. A kid so caught up in it all that there was no room for anything else. Another kid for whom nothing in life would ever be so glorious, so fulfilling as playing high school football. Trapper didn't see the game as being a savior for these kids. He saw it as the kiss of death. These kids think they're invincible. They put that P on their helmet and that black and white. They think nobody can kick their ass. It doesn't matter what state you're from, how many players you got on your team. They're popular. They're in very hot demand, like a hot rock group. No matter what they do, it's a hit. Everything they do is right, and they just can't find that again. What other job can they find that has that glamour? What's the substitute? Find the substitute for it. The only consequence of it is a mentally crippling disease for the rest of your life. Trapper knew the amount of sacrifice the kids went through to be Permian football players. How they were willing to play with the blessing of their parents, with broken feet and broken ankles and broken wrists. "How much better would it be if they concentrated that into school?" he asked. "How much better would it be if they concentrated it into a job?" A graduate of the University of Iowa, he had been a student trainer there on a wrestling team that won the national championship. Iowa was a wrestling-mad school, but the intensity was nowhere near what it was in Odessa over football. The relationship nowhere near as intertwined. Trapper loved Friday nights as much as anyone. He got caught up in the game as much as anyone. But he always had another season to look forward to if this one didn't happen to work out. He knew these kids had no soft cushion. The second the season was over, they became vague, fuzzy shapes, as indistinguishable as the thick clouds that skimmed across the sky into the horizon. They might come back to the locker room after a big game. Their favorite coach would give them a big, sincere hello and then quickly drift off because of more pressing needs, and they would paw around the edges of the joyous pandemonium, and it would become clear that it wasn't theirs anymore. It belonged to others who had exactly the same swagger of invincibility that once upon a time had been their exclusive right. Trapper knew he would get paid for what he did, no matter what happened during the course of a season. If this particular one ended Saturday in the quarterfinals of the Class 5A Texas playoffs against the Lamar Vikings, there might be some hurt, some disappointment at what could have happened, because this team clearly had the talent to go to state. But before long, the delicious anticipation of another season would come again. A new set of kids, a new set of faces, a new set of hopes, a new set of heroes would be paraded atop the shoulders of the town as gloriously as the Greeks honored their gods. "That's my salvation," he said. "What's their salvation?" But he also knew it was too powerful, too intoxicating to ever get away from, for those who played, and also for those who sat in the stands, cheering week after week, month after month, year after year. "It's the Friday night addiction," said Trapper. Part 3.
"This needle gonna hurt?" asked Ivory Christian as he lay on a table in the trainer's room.
"I hate needles."
"I know," said Team Doctor Weldon Butler.
"Don't look," said Trapper.
"It will give you some strength the second half," said Butler.
"I hate needles, Doc," Ivory said again, his voice quavering, scared.
"I know. I do, too. I'm afraid of needles." "Don't jump, Ivory. Make a fist and hold it."
He'd come off the field at halftime against the Lamar Vikings exhausted and complained to Butler that he didn't know if he was going to make it. He was quickly ushered into the trainer's room next to the dressing room, and the door was closed. Ivory, dressed in his uniform and smelling of sour sweat, groaned as the needle attached to the IV bag slipped into his vein. One of his feet, hanging over the edge of the table, began to shake, and it was clear he was terrified. The IV bag contained a solution of lactose. Such a procedure was a common method of replenishing depleted body fluids. It also had the psychological effect of making Ivory think that some magical power-packed supply of energy was coursing through his veins, a miracle potion to get him through the second half of a game in which a loss would mean the end of the season.
"Don't move," Butler said again. "You'll play the best second half you've played all year."
"I hate it," said Ivory.
"How long is the halftime?" asked Butler.
20 minutes, said Trapper.
"Long enough to get one in there," said Butler.
"I hate needles, man," Ivory said again. "They scare me."
But it didn't matter. The Lamar Vikings hadn't wilted at all under the hot sun of Odessa. The Permian lead at halftime was only 7-0, and the team couldn't afford to have an exhausted Ivory Christian at middle linebacker. If an IV solution normally used in hospitals and at the scene of accidents was now being used during the halftime of a high school football game to ease complaints of exhaustion, so be it. Only a month earlier, the atmosphere surrounding Ivory had been so different. Sitting on the bench in the middle of the last regular season game against San Angelo, he had said he could care less if he played anymore. During halftime, one of the coaches had criticized him for failing to play the trap correctly with a score 28-0 in Permian's favor, and he was seething over it. He was tired of studying the play sheets that filled a thick notebook, tired of being picked at and probed and poked for every detail. He was also upset when a fellow teammate at linebacker, David Fierro, suddenly got benched after starting all year.
"I don't like the Permian football program," he had said. "I don't want to play 6 more games. I'm ready to go home." "They think you're a super athlete just because you're black," he blurted out angrily. "They expect me to make the tackle."
When asked if he wanted the team to win the coin toss or not, he said nothing. Later in the week, anger had given way to the familiar feeling of ambivalence. The playoffs were coming up, and he knew from the year before how exciting that could be. But there was also a part of him that truly wished the season was over. He questioned his own commitment to the game, wondering if he hit as hard as he had in the past. "If someone hailed me or cheap-shotted me or called me something, I went off on them. No mercy, no prisoners. That's how I got my reputation as a brute." But he wasn't sure if the same instinct was still there. "Mojo used to be serious to me before I got up here," said Ivory. "It's just another football team to me now. It's got a winning tradition. It's got good players. But I got other things to do besides football and getting people sacked up." His interest in preaching seemed as strong as ever. It was the only area, as he saw it, that he could freely express himself. Just as there was a part of Ivory that didn't think he hit people hard enough on the football field, there was a part of Ivory that felt he hadn't dedicated enough of himself to the church. He said he looked forward to the moment football ended, and he could spend all his free time working with Jesus, working with Christ. He dreamed of someday becoming the pastor of the largest Baptist church in California, with a congregation of 1,000 and a 400-strong choir behind him. He dreamed of how he would get a bachelor's degree in communications or business management, and then a doctorate in theology. He dreamed of the day people would respectfully address him as Dr. Christian. And then, with a phone call from a college football recruiter, all those dreams began to fade away. Around the time the playoffs started, Texas Christian University, a Southwest Conference school, spoke to Ivory. A recruiter told him they were interested and that a good showing in the playoffs might cement a scholarship, and it was hard to think about anything else after that. Once the team got caught up in the playoffs, Ivory never preached again. His aspirations in life also changed. He saw a new light now, a new path, and it didn't come to him in some fantastic, surreal dream as the call to preach had. He wanted to be a major college football player. The thought of playing for another 6 weeks in the playoffs no longer filled him with questions. Like everyone else, he wanted the season to go on forever. In the past, he had had the reputation of being recalcitrant, stubborn, a player who marched to his own beat and always seemed to fight off the brainwashing aspects of the Mojo mystique. But it was hard to see any evidence of that behind the closed door of the trainer's room, silent except for the dripping of a spilled cup of Coke into a drain, like the sound of rain falling against a window pane in the dark of night, where a student trainer stood above him, squeezing on the IV bag to send that clear fluid through Ivory's veins as fast as it could possibly go. He played a wonderful second half against the Lamar Vikings. The heat, which had turned him laggard in the first half, no longer seemed to affect him. Lamar scored a touchdown early in the third quarter to tie the game 7-7, but Winchell threw a 28-yard touchdown pass to Hill to once again take the lead. The crowd of 14,500, sensing the kill, rose to its feet on almost every play. The cries of "Mojo! Mojo! Mojo!" louder than they ever had been. Almost scary. J.J. Joe, the highly touted Viking quarterback with an arm that was even better than his name, became rattled by the deafening, frenzied sounds enveloping the stadium. And Ivory was everywhere, lunging to make an arm tackle, speeding past blockers to break up a pass and push the receiver to the ground as if he were a little kid. He was truly inspired, and so was the rest of the team. Permian beat the Lamar Vikings 21-7, and with the win, the team was on its way to the Final Four, the semifinals of the Texas High School Playoffs, a breath away from the promised land that some of the players had dreamed about since they were old enough to walk. What Ballou had talked about the week before, how there was nothing else like winning a state championship, wasn't something abstract now, but something they could feel. After all that work, they were so close, so magically close. But an enormous obstacle lay